Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Good afternoon and welcome back to the show. I'm Julia Hartley-Brewer and you are with Talk TV. Still with me in the studio is former senior military intelligence officer Philip Ingram. And we are still asking you, of course, to get in touch with us about some of the biggest news of the day. Well, we certainly thought before announcements from the SNP this morning, the Labour government, if they get in at the end of this year, would renationalise Britain's railway network within 5 years. The idea would be they would effectively, as each franchise comes up for renewal, they would just take it back into government ownership, so they wouldn't actually be shelling out billions of pounds to buy those back. It wouldn't cost the taxpayer anything. They say, indeed, we'd be saving money. I want to know, do you back the policy? Don't you back the policy? Tell us why you do. Tell us why you don't. Give us a call on 0344 499 1000. Text on 87222 or get in touch on X at Talk TV. Calls are charged at the national rate. Text costs one standard network rate message. Look forward to getting more of your messages on air. Look forward also to hearing more from Philip Ingram. First up, though, I'm delighted to say joining me right now to talk about the current state of British politics. If only there was anything in the news to talk about, it's a veteran broadcaster and journalist Andrew Neil. Good afternoon to you, Andrew.
Good afternoon to you.
Speaking to us from, hopefully, sunny France.
Sun is shining. It's gone behind a cloud at the moment, but it's shiny and warm. I was in London earlier this
year. Yeah, you know, it's spring in London. You know the deal. I suppose the first thing I should ask you about is actually about your homeland, Scotland. The announcement this morning after a special emergency cabinet meeting called by Humza Yousaf, the First Minister and leader of the SNP, that the coalition that's been running Scotland since 2021 is no more. The Greens are, whether they've left or been ousted, they are no more. The relationship brought a number of successes, said Humza Yousaf, and the benefits of outwired the compromises. But the balance has shifted and it no longer serves its purpose and no longer guarantees stability. What do you make of that as a proud Scotsman?
Well, it lasted for 2.5 years and it gave the SNP a majority in the Scottish Parliament. The Scottish the SNP, though, paid a price for that in that it became hostage to pretty much an extremist movement within British politics, which is what the Scottish Greens are. I mean, this is a party that wanted to investigate whether 8-year-olds should be able to change their gender ID, 8-year-olds, wanted to stop the proscription of Hamas as a terrorist organisation. And everything it tried, most of it failed. It cost tens of millions trying to get a bottle recycling scheme. That didn't work. It wanted to ban fishing in coastal areas. That didn't work either. It had to reject there. But above all, it was the driving force behind the gender recognition bill of self-identification for 16 and over. And that kind of influence is now gone from the Scottish government, not entirely, but the more extreme side of it's gone. But of course, the Scottish government no longer has an overall majority. It almost has an overall majority. Mm. It's only one seat short of it, but it cannot now get its way on everything.
Do you think that's a good thing for the people of Scotland or not? Because you've always been very, we were interviewing a BBC and, you know, neutral interviewer, you know, putting the case to people like Nicola Sturgeon, largely sort of deified by the British media over the years, about her actual record in government. I mean, yes, there's the main aim of the SNP is for Scottish independence, but in terms of actually as a governing party in Scotland, the record is dire.
Well, the SNP, given that independence is now looking very much a long shot, I mean, the whole purpose of the SNP is to separate Scotland from the rest of the United Kingdom. That is looking harder and harder. I think that ship has sailed. It means the SNP will then have to fight on its record. And on its record, when it comes to health, education, transport, infrastructure investment, the record's pretty dire. You really wouldn't want to run on it. Waiting lists are longer. The education system, the school system in particular, which used to be one of the finest in the world, is now, for the first time in history, much worse than the English system. That's never happened before. Falling down the international league tables. So that's a pretty dire record it has to go on, which is why I suspect they'll probably lose the coming Holyrood election, and they'll lose a lot of seats in the coming general election. It does mean now, shorn of the extremist Scottish Greens, they can begin to edge a bit back to the mainstream. But, I mean, a bit like the Tories in London, there's a general feeling that their time is up. They've been in power for 17 years, which is even longer than the Conservatives at Westminster. And there comes a time when you've been in power for that long and you're not going anywhere. You've run out of ideas. There's a general sense you're a failure, which is the case in Westminster and the case in Edinburgh, that no matter what you do, your time is up.
Well, it is interesting, isn't it, watching what's happening in what is most likely to be an election year, although technically it could go all the way to January, but I think it'd be a foolish, any foolish Prime Minister who thinks that people are in a good mood to vote in January and everyone's pretty much as poor as they're going to be all year sitting in the cold, unless they've got the, can afford their central heating, and who can do that anymore? But we do just see so much more attention now going on what Sir Keir Starmer and what the Labour Party would do if they do get elected in the next election. Big policy announcement, renationalisation of the railway system across the country, basically taking those franchises as they gradually come to their end over the next 5 years, which all of them will, back into public ownership, some already in public ownership. You and I mean, you're a little, if you don't mind me saying, a little bit longer than me, been around a long time, watched the debates over all of this. This is a policy which Jeremy Corbyn was pushing, and much to the chagrin of the Tory party at the time, is a very popular policy, is it not? Something like 70% support. What do you make of it?
I suspect it's quite popular because most people now are too young to remember British Rail when it was owned by the state, whereas I do. I would say a number of things about this. First of all, the privatisation of the railways has not been a great success. It's been very messy and wasn't done properly. So it's not something, say, unlike the privatisation of British Airways or British Telecom or other things like that. It's not something you'd really want to fight too much for. Secondly, as you alluded, a huge chunk of the railway system is already state-owned now. It's either state-owned or it's controlled by the state, the permanent way, the track, the infrastructure. That's already owned by the state. And the operating companies, the ones that that own the trains, are highly regulated by the state already. So was this a big announcement? I mean, I heard the Shadow Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, announce it. But she wasn't really quite sure what was going to happen. And she seemed to be saying something a little bit different from her shadow transport secretary. It seems that what they're going to do is they're not going to spend any money to do this. They'll wait on the operating company's franchises coming to an end. And then rather than issue new franchises, they'll take it back into public ownership.
Which is the sensible way to do it, surely.
It's a clever way to do it if you want to save money. It also means there'll be no real difference. For a long while to come. It'll be very slow. It'll take more than one Labour government term and people won't really notice the difference. The difference is, to use an apt metaphor, down the track. And down the track is this, that if all these operating companies come back into public ownership, the renewal of their infrastructure, the renewal of their trains, of their carriages, of the service they provide, that all then comes back onto the public balance sheet. The taxpayer will have to pay for that. And one of the features of British Rail in the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, was that because it was state-owned, when it came to government spending cuts, British Rail was always the first to be cut. It's why it was among European rail services, slow to get out of steam, slow to electrify. A lot of lines are still not electrified, took a wrong turn with diesel. And, of course, what never happened when it was wholly owned by the state was that we never built a high-speed network.
Yeah. I don't think we ever will. We're not very good at building anything in this country anymore. That is part of the problem. It's going to be interesting to watch all that. It's going to be interesting to watch if we do see a Labour government, actually, the reaction of many people who are... Yeah, everything's terrible in this country. Nothing works. We want everything to be better. They're going to vote Labour. Well... What do you think is going to change? What would be the fundamental change, say, after 5 years of a Labour government, if we do get a Labour government later this year?
Well, I don't think you need to go 5 years. I mean, I think we are going to get a Labour government. That would be the only issue is how big the majority is. And I think the Tories themselves need an opposition to try and reconfigure what they're all about and try and get their act together. I think the problem that Mr. Starmer will face and his shadow cabinet is that they'll probably be deeply unpopular within 6 months. And that in a number of issues, they'll probably be out of their depth. I mean, the current Conservative cabinet is pretty lackluster, not very impressive, full of people who are barely up to the job. And I feel that once Labour gets into power, that will be the same, may even be a little bit worse because they're new, very few of a previous experience of government, so it'll take them a while to get there. The Shadow Chancellor has put them in a bit of a fiscal straitjacket. I mean, the purpose of Labour, above all, is to spend. That's Labour governments come to power because they want to spend on things that they think are important. And yet the fiscal straitjacket that Rachel Reeves is imposing will mean there'll be very little room to spend. And I think that will cause a lot of deep unhappiness. And it means that for a long while, you won't actually see that much difference because Labour spending plans are basically
They're pretty much the same. They're going to have exactly the same in-tray that Rishi Sunak and his cabinet have. And one particular area of spending that's been in the news this week, of course, is defence spending. I know you write an awful lot about what's going on in international affairs as well. We focus a lot on Ukraine over the recent years in this show and also obviously a lot on the Middle East as well in the last 6 months or so. We had this announcement from Rishi Sunak that we're going to see spending on the military going up to 2.5% of GDP over the next 5 years. Of course, given that no one expects him to be in office, it's an easy play. He may as well say 10% of GDP because he's not going to realistically have to fulfil that pledge. The Labour Party haven't said they will agree to that. They've been accused by Labour by Oliver Dowd and the Deputy Prime Minister of failing to keep Britain safe in a dangerous world. Do you think we should be spending more on defence? And if so, how much? And where should our focus be?
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
I don't think there's any question we should be spending more on defence. All Western democracies should be spending more on defence. The history of the 21st century has been the history of the success of autocracy. The autocrats are on the march. They've been on the march into parts of the old Soviet Empire. They've been on the march in Ukraine. They're threatening Taiwan. They're building bases in the Pacific, in the Eastern Pacific Rim to expand their power. Autocracy has been the consistent message of the 21st century, and the democracies need to get their act together, which is why, although Rishi Sunak's statement yesterday is welcome, it is nowhere near enough. It's better than nothing. But, I mean, I'll let you into a secret. Defence spending in Britain's already about 2.3%. To increase it to 2.5% by 2030 is peanuts. And to say you're putting the country on a war footing because you're increasing spending by 0.2%, you know, by a digital percentage point or two, this seems to me to be inadequate to the job.
What sort of numbers do you think we should be spending? I mean, we see ourselves...
Well, I would think that... And, of course, it all has to be done in cooperation with our allies, particularly, you know, the only other military power that matters in Europe is France, and they're spending more on defence too. We should be cooperating a lot more with the French, because together, Anglo-French forces are formidable. We're the only two nuclear powers in Europe as well. We have a lot of assets that the French don't have, and the French have a lot of assets that we don't have, though we're in a peculiar situation for a sea power that at the moment we've allowed the situation to develop where even the French Navy is bigger than the British Navy. I mean, who would have thought that? Yeah. France traditionally being a land-based power. So, I mean, I'd have thought we should go to 2.5% immediately, otherwise you're not on a war footing. And we should be aiming for 3% before the end of the decade if we want to be taken seriously. There is already a huge gap in defence spending, and much of this extra money will just go in to fill the gap.
It's not actually going to provide any extra capability. Can I ask you...
Yeah, it's not going to mean much bigger. It's not going to mean a bigger Air Force, it's not going to mean a bigger Army, and it's not going to mean a bigger Navy, all of which Britain needs to have the defences to win this assault of the autocracies on Western democracy.
And where is the biggest threat coming from? Because we know America's facing an awful lot, focusing more on, you know, on China. We see there, and that Xi Jinping has put his government effectively on a war footing in terms of his expenditure. We know Russia, you know, 40% or so of government spending is now on the spending on the war effort in Ukraine. Huge amount of effort on that. We're nowhere near that in the West, even in America. And although America's got bigger forces, where is the biggest threat coming from for you?
At the moment, the biggest threat is clearly Russia. And because if Russia was to have a breakthrough in Ukraine, and basically Ukraine was to lose either outright or to lose 70-80%, and Russia was to remain ensconced in most of Ukraine for the foreseeable future, I doubt Mr. Putin would stop there. He would then look for other weaker points in the NATO alliance and begin to push there. It's what he's done all along. He's kept on moving. He went into Crimea. He went into the Donbass. He went into Georgia. He's now going into Ukraine. Why would he stop there if he wins in Ukraine? Which is why it's very important that we bolster our NATO defenses, that Britain plays a major role on that. We can't count on the Americans because they've got the Pacific to deal with too. The people who get this are the Poles. They're spending real money on defense. Yeah. They're building a major army, 250,000 strong. They're buying in 1,000 tanks and 1,000 fighter jets from South Korea. They are going to be the force that matters. It's our job to be there to help them defend it. Because if one NATO country goes down and we don't do anything about it, NATO is finished. Yeah. And all of Eastern Europe will become Serbia to Russia.
Yeah, I still wonder whether we have faith that actually NATO powers will actually come to the aid of if one of our number is actually under attack. Can I ask you, with the November election coming, not necessarily in this country, but certainly on November the 5th in America, and I put this question to Liz Truss, which was in the studio a couple of weeks ago, will the world be a safer place after January next year when the next president is in office under President Trump or President Biden?
I don't think the world would be a safer place with either of them in the White House. I think that there is a change taking place in American policy, which is more protectionist, more isolationist, ask questions about what Europe got to do with us, which were the kind of questions that are asked in the 1930s as well. Wonders whether America can be both a superpower in our hemisphere, in the European hemisphere, and deal with the rising power of China at the same time. Mr. Trump's rhetoric is not at all helpful. He says some really stupid things about NATO. He doesn't realize the importance of NATO to the defense of the United States. But Mr. Biden also sometimes doesn't seem to realize what is required for Europe as well. The one plus that Mr. Biden would have is that he is likely to have around him some pretty grown-up advisors. Whereas I'm not sure that's going to be the case in a Trump administration.
Certainly a concern. Just finally, we know that, you know, we're not just talking about military hardware in terms of how the West is under attack. We've also got, of course, cyber warfare, an awful lot going on social media as well and going on with in many other forms. You've been a stalwart in terms of protecting media, newspaper independence over the years when you were the editor of the Sunday Times. You're now the chairman of The Spectator, and you have faced extraordinary situation where there was bidding going on. It looked like, basically, to all intents and purposes, the United Arab Emirates government-owned body was going to have a chance to buy and take over ownership of The Spectator magazine in this country, extraordinarily backed by George Osborne, the former Chancellor. You've overcome that. The other day you were in a select committee hearing in the Commons, and I was cheering you on as you were asking, what sort of government input should there be in the media world? And you just basically said, none. Get out of it. You're rubbish at what you do in the government. Don't get involved in what we do. Do you stand by that?
Well, I only said it yesterday, so I better stand by it. Otherwise, I'm even more inconsistent than the politicians you interview. I was asked that if there are gaps or weaknesses in news gathering and news coverage of the media, both in newspapers, magazines and broadcasters, what should the government role be? And my answer there was the government should have no role. It should not be in the news business at all. I don't want the government in the news business. The moment government gets into the news business, as you see in Canada or in France, where the government is ubiquitous, then the media loses its cutting edge. It loses its independence. It loses its ability to hold governments to power. There is, but as I also testified yesterday, but of course it got no coverage at all, there is a role for government, but it's a role for government as in all industry, not just media. There is a role for government to ensure a level playing field, to ensure that no one becomes too dominant, that there's no monopoly power, and that the market always stays open for newcomers and insurgents. That's the job of government. It's not the, and that's a job in media business as well as in every other business, from steel to digital and so on. What it is not the job of government to do is to get involved in the news business. It's our job to hold them to account, not to take their subsidies.
Do you, just finally, do you think that, I mean, that's a big part of freedom of speech, your ability to publish, to, you know, to broadcast. Do you think that under the current environment we have with newspapers, magazines, social media, and indeed broadcast media like ourselves here at Talk, do you think that we do have enough freedom of speech and enough protection for people?
I think we have a lot of freedom of speech in Britain, yes. And I think we have some pretty good protections, though, as you and I will both know, the libel laws are still far too tight in Britain. There's still a bit of a centre for where people want to come and sue the media. I think the biggest danger is not government rules or anything like that. It's the biggest danger in this, as editors we have in our own hands, is that we run frightened of social media lynch mobs. And, you know, one of the New York Times, it's happened to them. Companies are terrified of it. There's a big gang gets up. And in the end, Twitter, or whatever it's called now, X, becomes your editor because you don't want to fall foul of these lynch mobs. Well, it's the job of strong editors to stand up to these lynch mobs. After all, they're only metaphorical lynch mobs. They're not actually coming with a rope to hang you. And don't let your publications, your broadcasters, your newspapers, your magazines by edited by these social media lynch mobs. Ignore them. Tell them where to go. You're the editor. You're in charge of your own free speech. You stand up for it. And do not be intimidated by people who spend their lives trying to intimidate you. If we want to maintain the freedom of the press, which is one of the most valuable things that we have in this country, it is within our own hands to guarantee that, to stand up to those who would try to shut us up. And that's what we need to do.
Here to all of that. Andrew Neil, pleasure to have your company. I hope you'll come on again. There's plenty more I'd love to ask you about. Really appreciate you joining us there. Go and enjoy some sunshine in France.
Thank you very
Andrew much. Andrew Neil, thank you. Still with me in the studio is Philip Ingram. I'm sure you want to come back on some of the things he had to say about defence there, because that's your area of expertise, of course.
Yeah, so much in there. You're in the threat, he's 100% right. The short-term threat is from Russia. The longer-term threat is from China. But we have to recognise that China is setting the conditions for how it's going to exploit that in the future.
And China is enabling Russia anyway, isn't it, by allowing Russia to sell cheap oil to them.
It is, very much so. Yeah. And what Andrew was saying about, you know, the poll goals and their expansion and their being the biggest in Europe, they spend less money than we do. So
yes, because they're a small, no, but they're a smaller country, but they've got the fighting force. We don't have 250,000 fighting force.
We don't have that, and we will have 100.
Can't fill Wembley
Stadium. We will have 143 tanks, and they're getting 1,000. Now that shows we're getting our spending wrong, and they're getting their spending right.
They've got less money, but they're getting more stuff. Where does all our money go on defence? I mean, a lot of it's on Trident.
Well, there is a big chunk on Trident, but a lot of it is going on.
That doesn't mean it's badly spent.
A lot of it is going on bureaucracy. And yes, our nuclear deterrent has kept the peace since the Second World War, and it's important that we support that.
Yeah, and again, when people say, like, well, you know, if Iran gets a nuclear weapon, then you can't do anything about it. It's like, well, that's why we have our nuclear weapon.
Exactly.
Philip Ingram, always great to have your thoughts. Thank you.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.